My name's Mackenzie, and I started a GoFundMe for the adoptive mother of a nonverbal autistic child. The mother had lost her job because she wasn't able to find adequate care for this autistic child. So she really needed some help with living expenses, paying some back bills. So I launched a GoFundMe to help support them during this crisis. And we raised about $10,000 within just a couple of months. I think that the surprising thing was by telling a clear story and just like really being very clear about what we needed, we had some really generous donations from people who were really moved by the situation that this family was struggling with.
GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform trusted by over 200 million people. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This podcast is supported by GoFundMe.
Welcome to the History Hotline, a direct line to a better understanding of all things Black history and beyond. And welcome to another episode of the History Hotline. My name is Deanna Lincook, and as always, I'll be your host today. Now, for those of you that listen regularly, you'll know that there hasn't actually been an episode for a while. And for that, I apologise. I ended up taking an unplanned break, let's call it that, a very much unplanned but much needed break. And I am back now. With regularly scheduled episodes every fortnight from now on. So apologies for that, for my absence. I really hope you didn't miss me too much. But we're back and I'm excited. I've got a good few episodes planned. I've got some exciting interviews coming up in the next few weeks, as well as an episode today, episode 131, which is all about reggae music. And it's an episode that was based on my undergrad dissertation, actually, which was all about reggae music in the 1970s. So obviously focusing specifically on Jamaican history. I didn't look at reggae in the UK or how it travelled or anything. I kept it to a focus on Jamaica as I was studying Caribbean history. I'm not sure how I then got from reggae music in my undergrad dissertation to actually histories of childhood and migration by my PhD, but here we are, and that is where we started, should I say, when it came to like long form academic writing. I wanted to do an episode about reggae music, partly because I had this research just sat, and the process of writing my undergrad dissertation wasn't one that filled me with joy, considering actually how not negative I found the experience. I didn't really love the project I was doing by the time I got to like maybe the middle of it, should we say, and definitely hated it by the end. So it's a piece of work that I cringe going back to, like I hated it. And I think most people that write things, when you go back to writing that you've done in the past, sometimes you can think, oh, actually, this was actually not as bad as I thought. But occasionally it's like, oh, why did I say that? Why did I write that? And that's how I felt it was going to be when I looked back at this piece of work. But it wasn't actually awful. I was like, actually, this is some cool information that I actually would like to share with you. One day I do intend to actually write it up into like some articles or something that could potentially sit somewhere. But that's not today's task or even this year's task. I think it's important to start maybe with maybe your introduction to reggae music. With a certain person, which I would assume is probably Bob Marley. His music, I would argue, I mean, I don't think I'd even have to argue it. He's probably the most successful reggae artist with probably the biggest reach on the globe. And probably definitely the most prolific Jamaican musical artist, considering as well he has obviously passed away decades ago, but his music still carries, and it further continues on in its legacy, with the Bob Marley One Love film, which came out a few weeks ago from me recording this episode in early March. Now, I start this episode with a key moment in Jamaican musical and political history, which was the closing moment in the Bob Marley One Love film. I didn't necessarily want to make an episode about the film or reacting to the film, so if you're here for that, stick around, so I'll talk about it. But this is not a review. This is what I'm going to call an alternative history of this particular political and musical period. I watched a film a few weeks back and I just wish it had explored some of the themes of his music a little bit more in depth and his politics. I think the film, oh look at me, said I wasn't going to do a review but here I am. I think the film made Bob Marley seem apolitical, and it was a conversation I had with a friend where they were suggesting that yeah, the film made it seem like Bob Marley was completely apolitical, which I think is accurate in the sense that when it came to Jamaican politics, he didn't necessarily pick a side or have any ties, let's say, with one party, one political party over the other. But I believe he was extremely political in the sense of the word today. He had a strong sense of righteousness and what he felt was right by way of uplifting impoverished people through his music in Jamaica and globally. And I wish that came out a little bit more in the film. I will probably have to reference the film throughout. If you haven't watched it, then don't worry, because there's not going to be spoilers, because it's a biopic and shock horror, Bob Marley does die. If you didn't know that, then you've got no work to do. But I think it is quite interesting to have these points of reference. But as I said, what I'll be talking about in this episode today actually was kind of really quickly brushed over, passed over, referenced in the film, which in some cases, in some arguments, you know, that's really all they could do. It's a 90-minute film at the end of the day. And most people probably wanted a film that they could hear the music, that they could see how songs were made and the process and the conversations that were happening before songs came out. And that's always the kind of cool part about biopics, musical biopics, should I say. But I will start with this key moment that I mentioned a second ago, which was at the end of the film. And this moment occurred on April 22nd, 1978. Where Prime Minister of Jamaica at the time, Michael Manley, and leader of the opposition, Edward Seaga, joined Bob Marley, the global reggae icon, on stage at the One Love Peace concert at the National Stadium in Kingston, Jamaica. And if you haven't seen that picture or you haven't watched the film to have seen that picture, because they did use the original photo, please do have a look at that picture. It's iconic. It is an image that I think lives on. To this day, it's Bob Marley who stands in the middle of these two politicians with their hands raised in unity, unity at a time of extreme political and social divide in a post-colonial Jamaica. It's a striking image because it's the two most prominent political figures in the country at a time where Jamaica's going through a period of real serious political conflict. It's dividing the nation in a very violent way. And it's significant because of the fact that it was a reggae singer, Bob Marley, who was able to bring these two together. And in hope of a better future for Jamaica, a less violent future, one where political violence wasn't so rampant. I think it's quite iconic, maybe a better word could be used, but I just can't see the equivalent in many other places of a musical artist having that much influence to be able to have two politicians that aren't necessarily outwardly advocating for violence, but are at the head of two groups of people that are in a small minority, causing a lot of instability and violence, and bring them together on a stage and call for unity. And it's quite a contrast with Bob Marley, who is ever charismatic and energetic in his usual colourful ensemble in the middle of these two men dressed, you know, politically, professionally in their white shirts, kind of playing in a sense in regards to being on stage with all this colour and all this energy and all this vibrance. And he does this in front of not just the country, the island, the whole world. He uses this platform that he has built, other reggae artists have built. And I think this image is such an important image in highlighting this inseparable link that I argue is between music and contemporary politics in this 1970 era age, golden age of reggae. And I think it's such an important image. And the fact that it was at the end of the film was important. It was important that it was there. But I just think that that moment should have been illuminated as important as I feel like it was. I'm going to say a lot of things that are obviously my opinion. It's obviously my podcast, but I think I have strong feelings about, I think, parts of the film because I'd done some of the research on it and the politics of the time. And so this is not for me to necessarily slate the film, even though I didn't really enjoy it. It's not that. And if you are thinking of watching it, please do. Why not? Make up your own opinion about it. But I will be providing, I think, in this episode, further depth into some of the political, religious, if that's the right word, influences into reggae music that I feel like were brushed over in the film.
My name is Mackenzie, and I started a GoFundMe for the adoptive mother of a nonverbal autistic child. The mother had lost her job because she wasn't able to find adequate care for this autistic child. So she really needed some help with living expenses, paying some back bills. So I launched a GoFundMe to help support them during this crisis. And we raised about $10,000 within just a couple of months. I think that the surprising thing was by telling a clear story and just like really being very clear about what we needed, we had some really generous donations from people who were really moved by the situation that this family was struggling with.
GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform trusted by over 200 million people. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This podcast is supported by GoFundMe.
So I'm going to give it that depth. I'm going to flesh out those histories. I'm going to give you the context. That is what my aim is today. And maybe you listen to this before you watch the film, or you watch a film and then you listen to this and flesh out maybe some of your knowledge that you have about Bob Marley, about reggae music. And I'm not explicitly just going to talk about Bob Marley, because as important as he is in the story of reggae, he's not the only person that is a reggae artist or making reggae music in this time or ever. So, stick with me if you want to know more about reggae music, Jamaican politics, and the 1970s. In most, if not all, contexts, music is a form of culture, and this especially applies to reggae music, as it's directly linked to the historical trajectory of Jamaica, which I think in turn is then responsible for the cultural development of the island. Reggae music started with the people, Jamaican people. It's known by many as the voice of the oppressed. And reggae then evolved into music for all people, and its global reach is absolutely undeniable, but has remained a music that is so strongly and so deliberately linked to Jamaica. And I think it must always stay that way, as it's such a uniquely Jamaican genre, and a unique genre in the sense that it comes out of movements of the people. Reggae's always been unapologetically Jamaican. It's been unapologetically Rastafarian. It's been unapologetically political. And in this episode, I will be speaking mostly about the political influences on reggae music in the 1970s, and also touch on Rastafari and how that influenced and shaped reggae. I said I wouldn't really mention the film, and I feel like I keep saying that, and I'm going to stop now. But I think these are some of the things that should have come into the telling of the story of Bob Marley. Yes, obviously, it's only a 90-minute film, but the possibilities were endless. My dissertation argued that after this golden era of reggae, as I noted to be the 1970s, which is debatable in itself, this like political consciousness of reggae declined. And it was followed by an influx of individualism, materialism in a genre that derived from reggae music, which is dancehall. And I felt like that was seen through US neocolonialism and increasing cultural influence from America, which could be seen in many ways through looking at lyrics and looking at the presentation of artists, but also in the way the music industry was operating as a kind of microcosm of this influence from the US. So back to reggae in the 70s. I'll start with Rastafari. I'm no expert, but I will give a brief history, as I think it's quite necessary to properly understand some of the beliefs at play and the common themes that run through the music. Arguably, Rastafari is a way of life, often categorised as a religion, sometimes because it centres on Abrahamic beliefs. I think it's probably... I see it in a way of like a, beyond a philosophy, but kind of as a life system that grows out of Jamaica under British colonial rule. In part, it was a dismissal of British monarchs as their ruler, as Jamaican people would have been in a British colony and their monarch would have been their leader. And it centres an identification with the Ethiopian emperor who of November 1930 was Prince Tafari Mekonnen, who was an alleged descendant of King Solomon of Judah and the Queen of Sheba, and was known post-coronation as Haile Selassie. But to Rastafarians, also the King of Kings, Lord of Lords, conquering lion of the tribe of Judah, and a manifestation of divinity of God in human form. The significance of his coronation comes from an interpretation of biblical scripture in Jamaica, which is kind of the spark of people like Leonard Howell, whose stories featured in the documentary film The First Rasta. Also, people that kind of notable and we think about in this time, Archibald Dunkley, Joseph Hilbert, Robert Hines, they all start preaching about Rastafari. And most of the research on this comes from Barry Chavannes. I think I'm pronouncing his name right. I read a tweet once that said, like, if you read, you don't know how to pronounce things because you've never heard it pronounced before. So please forgive me. Also, please forgive any sounds that sound like construction work coming from behind me. I have attempted to record this episode a few times. And every time I've done it, I feel like the builders outside have deliberately they've seen me recording and they have set up the building work and pulled out the loudest drills and machinery known to man. And so whilst it's only, you know, I can edit things, but I'm not that good. So if you do hear a drill in the back, please, please forgive me. But for the sake of this episode ever seeing the light of day, it was just necessary for me to sit down and record now. I'm tempted to put like my duvet over my head and like kind of box the sound in, but also I don't know if that will be any more helpful because these drills are really loud. Anyway, back to Barry. Barry Chavannes writes Rastafari and other African Caribbean worldviews, and there was particularly a section called Introducing the Native Religions of Jamaica, which I think the opening section of the text, which I found really useful. Barry is a Jamaican scholar and anthropologist and discusses various aspects of Rastafarianism. His work emphasizes its roots in African spiritual traditions, the social, political dimensions of it, and also its resistance, which I think is most important, to colonialism and oppression, and portrays it as a unique set of religious beliefs, systems, practices that are obviously unique to Jamaica within this very specific historical and social context. So the people that begin this movement in Jamaica took their name from a combination of Ras, meaning prince in Ethiopian, and Tafari, meaning after the, newly crowned emperor. And biblical scriptures that were used and interpreted to be significant were taken from Songs of Solomon 1:5-6, where it says, and I quote, I am black, but comely, O ye daughters of Jerusalem, as the tents of Kedar, as the curtains of Solomon. Look not upon me because I am black, because the sun hath looked upon me. And their interpretation of this specific passage was that King Solomon was black, so Jesus Christ must have been too, as they were both descendants of the lineage of David. This is in line with the view that the Bible is a text distorted by colonial powers to promote white supremacy. Hence, you know, blonde-haired, blue-eyed, white Jesus. Rasta's aim to reclaim this holy book by highlighting the African-based elements that promote racial consciousness and a pride in being black. Through an understanding of the Bible and the way it was distorted. Reggae has definitely always, I think, been inseparable to Rastafarianism. And through an exploration into the roots of it, I think there are three main principles which are significant in reggae music and feature in the lyrics of reggae quite heavily. And through the work of Barry Chavannes, of course, Horace Campbell, Dick Hebridge, Anita M. Waters, whose work I kind of cited quite heavily in my dissertation. There are three main principles which underpin Rastafarianism and are central to the lyrics in reggae music. These three core beliefs: firstly, acceptance that Rastafari is a true living God. Secondly, the idea that salvation can only come through repatriation to Africa, specifically Ethiopia. And thirdly, a central credence of race consciousness and black pride. And I think those are the kind of three main ways to highlight the ways in which these beliefs influenced reggae music. Reggae lyrics tend to draw on biblical scripture, even though I'd say Rastafarianism rejects Christianity, but through a way of a Rastafarian interpretation, as well as contemporary political topics, in order to put forward their message. An example of this was Bob Marley's opening to his 1971 song with the Wailers, Revolution. It opens with, and of course I'm not going to sing, Revelation reveals the truth. Revelation. And it actually goes on in the second verse, I guess you could call it. Never make a politician grant you a favour. They will always want to control you forever. And I feel like, first of all, the reference to Revelation, as in the biblical book, is clear. And also, similarly, in his 1977 track Exodus, calls on the book of Exodus to tell the story of Moses. He also calls to Jah to send us another brother Moses. I would say, I don't think it would be wild to say, that a lot of the kind of early Rastas come from potentially Christian backgrounds, whether that be because of the way that colonial Jamaica was set up, or maybe even Christian, and I say Christian as a loose denominational term, homes. And so they would be grounded or have some awareness at the very least of traditional Christian practices, beliefs, and biblical scripture. And so you see these references to the Bible popping up in a lot of reggae music. And also that note about not trusting politicians, I think, links back to the point that we were making earlier about Bob Marley being, quote unquote, apolitical. The belief in these particular scriptural interpretations, I think, are exacerbated by the fact that Marcus Garvey himself preached that people should, and I quote, look to Africa for the crowning of a king to know that your redemption is nigh, which led them to the conclusion, Marcus Garvey being a heavy influence within the movement, that the redemption of the African race was therefore at hand. I feel like I need to do a whole episode on Marcus Garvey, probably a whole series at some point. Stay tuned. References to Haile Selassie in different forms, I think, are scattered across reggae lyrics. For example, Burning Spears, Hail Him, H.I.M., starts with the lyrics, Hail Jatafari, said twice, giving glory to God on earth. Jah, obviously referring to God, as some interpret Jah to be a contraction of Jehovah, which is another name for God within Christianity. Freddie McKay's Arise Selassie, I Arise, starts with the same statement, as McKay calls on Selassie I to rise and come because everybody wants to see you. This strong belief in Rastafari is significant within Rastafarianism, as Haile Selassie is said to be the second coming of Christ. Furthermore, as a key to redemption is through him and Ethiopia, ideas of race, pride and repatriation take on a higher level and form of significance. George Lamming's observations about Rastafarianism, I think, are important in understanding some of the social and political climate in which it was formed. Although it's primarily categorised as a religion, it's also, and I quote, a political phenomenon that has gained international attention as a Pan-African approach to the problems of poverty, alienation and spirituality. For the most part, and it's what Lamming's observations are, Rastafari is very much kind of sidelined. It's a marginalised group of people. It was seen as an undesirable cult, and I quote. And to an extent, even within society today, I would say, still perceived as that and those who live alongside of it. The political consciousness is visible through the analysis of this way of life, as it puts forward really strong ideas about race and blackness in the Caribbean. And it's very clear that reggae is very much concerned with race and blackness and racial pride. And these social critiques and political protests can be seen in tracks like Bob Marley and the Wailers, Get Up, Stand Up from 1975, One Love, People Get Ready, 1977. However, I think it's really important to say, and I could never talk about this without saying, a lot of early scholarship, anyway, that I was coming across when doing this research regarding Rastafarianism was really weighed down by the fallacious claims of violence and crime within Rastafari communities, especially in reference to this, and I quote, the heat of West Kingston. These claims have not only, I think, unconstructively affected early scholarship on this way of life and on this religion, but have also shaped the way that the police and the kind of political elites have treated this community of people, especially in the 1960s and 1970s in Jamaica. Terry Lacey's study on violence and politics in Jamaica in 1970 mentions several instances of hyperbolic or just completely fictionalized accounts of Rastafarians involved in violent crime. The Coral Gardens incident of 1963, the Henry Rebellion of 1959 to 1960, and the Rodney Riots of 1968 are a few examples of a handful of Rastafarians involved with criminal activity in the name of a political movement. However, this amount is negligible when compared to the movement as a whole. Nevertheless, through scholarship and through public opinion, it has tarred Rastafarianism, it's tarred the Rasta name, and further enhanced negative stereotypes of this community. And Lacey kind of concludes, and I quote, that the associations between Rastafarians and violence, which was incidentally almost completely without foundation. And it is the case that historians and anthropologists that have studied the movement in a more objective way, such as Barry Chavannes, Horace Campbell, further argue this, stating, and Campbell states that there's a stamp of criminality placed on Rastafarians to give rise to state violence, not just in Jamaica, but also in Britain, as Jamaicans overseas began to adopt the religion and take on the beliefs and practices. Of the examples used by Lacey, most were instances of Rastafarians standing up for their beliefs and against the treatment and oppression they were facing at the hands of the police, which was horrific. Some had their locks cut off, some were beaten, some were unjustly arrested, especially in the case of Coral Gardens. And this early scholarship that is really pushing these damaging stereotypes negatively impacted Rastafarians and the perception that upper and middle class Jamaicans had towards them was, and Anita Waters says, and I quote, full of disgust due to their criminal behaviours, which we've already argued was a kind of hyperbolic reaction. The movement grows out of the Kingston ghettos as the urban population grows due to increased poverty. And whilst this treatment was unnecessarily brutal, that it's a similar treatment, but not all the same, I think, because of the kind of communities that are being formed around Rastafarianism, is also being bestowed on the lower classes of Jamaica generally. Barry Chavannes correctly links this, like, peasant class with the growth of Rastafarianism, as that being the kind of point that the movement grows from. And this belief develops into the idea that reggae then becomes a voice of Rastafarians. It becomes a voice of this peasant class of people that were finding themselves oppressive in a colonial Jamaican society that is reaching a point of independence, but also still really hanging on to the colonial beliefs. And this, what is it, the colonial hangover, is that what it's called? It's still very there, very much present and clear. Rastafarianism was most definitely and still is a socially and politically conscious movement. And Anita Waters argues that it was a movement seeking to make the black man something more than a squatter in his own country, seeking to build Africa in Jamaica. And I think this links to the idea that political consciousness impacted reggae music, was an artistic outlet for those being brutalized by society, and the music was a release for all this. I think Rastafarianism is clearly a root influence on reggae music, but also intertwined within this political struggle that's existing at this time in Jamaica. And although it is the case that politics has influenced reggae music, I think reggae music has also influenced politics, as politicians have taken slogans directly from reggae lyrics. Anita Waters also talks about in her work that beginning in 1972, Jamaican political parties used Rastafarian symbols and reggae music in electoral propaganda. Prime Minister Michael Manley used election slogans "Better Must Come" by Delroy Wilson, "Who God Bless, No One Curse," "Thank God I'm Past the Worst," "Better Must Come One Day," "Better Must Come, They Can't Conquer Me." You know, they're borrowing, taking, stealing these lyrics. This positivity is a recurring theme within Rasta-influenced reggae, and also highlights some of the sentiments of the People's National Party, the PNP, in the 1972 election, which they actually went on to win. Anita Waters argues that this kind of use of religion and music, morality by politicians during elections is quite a common tactic. She notes that in Jamaica, if you go back to the 1930s, religious songs like "Onward Christian Soldiers" and "Fight the Good Fight" were used. In Trinidad, Calypsonians composed campaign slogans for politicians. If we go to Africa, in Sierra Leone, the nationalist movement used symbols from tribal religious societies. And whilst Edward Seaga did not take Rastafarian influences in his 1980 election campaign, he was still successful. He did instead use other symbols of the black lower classes. He used the evangelical church to supply this like moral backing that was needed in his campaign. And so we here have some examples of politicians borrowing from popular culture, whether that's a religious culture or music culture, in order to promote themselves within election campaigns. Seaga actually turned away from the roots culture that Rastafarianism preached and moves towards this evangelical Christianity, which was popular more so in the United States, common in the Republican Party, as they became a big following for them. And I think also this kind of marks that turn that I was talking about, where reggae starts to see a shift and the US become involved and become an influence. But that's not for this episode, I will say. Reggae music is talking about oppression. It's talking about the woes of life. It's talking about the issues that, you know, these artists are seeing within their communities, within Jamaica, and they are raising it to a global platform. We're singing songs today that are about the social conditions of Jamaicans in the 1960s and 70s. And whilst we might not understand some of the meaning, or we might be able to take meaning and actually apply them to global situations and our own lives today, which is scary because realistically there should have been progress, but in a lot of cases there aren't. I think we can see just how influential the genre of music is. In May 1981, the reggae legend and global icon Bob Marley passed away. And I think he was, in ways, a personification of the link between Rastafarianism and reggae, as he used his beliefs to preach positivity, and his actions were wholly positive, for the most part, to a global community. Patricia Chin, who was owner of Studio 17, which was a recording studio in downtown Kingston, that Marley, alongside the likes of Peter Tosh, Gregory Isaacs, Bernard Spear, Toots and the Maytals, all recorded at some points in their careers. And she stated in an interview with Vogue that, and I quote, he carried a strong message with a positive outlook and people could universally identify with him. And I think that's why we've seen a Bob Marley film pop out in 2024, because his reach, his legacy is just undeniable. Some people link the death of Bob Marley with this so-called death of reggae. I don't think I agree. I think the fact that we have a 2024 film about Bob Marley shows that reggae isn't dead. Maybe it went to sleep for a little bit, but it definitely woke up. And there are so many artists that are still making reggae music today. Not necessarily with the same themes and the same message that we might have been used to from the 1970s. But, you know, it is still there. It is undisputed, I think, that he was the most successful reggae artist of his time to ever live. And I think it is a case that reggae music, it migrates, it influences other genres all over the world. It forms the basis for different political and social movements, not just in Jamaica, but to this global audience, which I think is so impressive and so cool, because it was a music and a movement that is born out of such a specific and unique struggle of people in Jamaica. But it's still, because I think many of our struggles as African diaspora globally, wherever we have found ourselves, is so similar. The themes are repeating, they're recurring. It is definitely the case that they still apply to us today. And it's, I think, the reason why reggae music is just so prolific. It also sounds amazing. I didn't speak sonically about reggae music because I am not that person. I'm nowhere near qualified. But I'm going to tell you this, I like the sound of it. It sounds good. It's nice music. You want to sing to it, you want to dance to it, you want to wind your waist. That is reggae music. And so this global reach that it has is obviously further pushed and carried by the beautiful way that it sounds, the melodies. I'm saying musical words, I have no idea what they mean. The melodies, the chords, whatever else. It sounds good. I think that's a point. Reggae music means a lot to a lot of people. It is a very influential genre of music, and Bob Marley being this kind of person that carries a genre in so many ways. He obviously isn't the only person that makes reggae music, and I don't want you to come away from this episode thinking that, but obviously with the film coming out, it centred him within this, and I think some of the kind of work he did and the moments he has also centres him. I think it would have been nice to see some of this in the film, and don't get me wrong, because some of it was included. I won't discredit that, but I think that's all I wanted to kind of say by providing this extra context, specifically linking to Rastafarianism and the social and political climate in the Caribbean, well, in Jamaica specifically, at that time that this music was being produced. I hope you have enjoyed this episode. I hope you've taken something away from it. And I wanted to thank you for your patience, because obviously there hasn't been an episode for a while. So thank you for listening. Thank you for, you know, tuning in. I normally finish my episodes with the things that I'm watching and the things that I'm reading, and this episode is no different. So I have been watching, I don't know if I've spoken about this on this podcast before. I think I have. There's a food documentary called High on the Hog, How African-American Cuisine Transformed America. And the first season came out in 2021, and the second season came out last year, the end of last year. And I thought I'd finished it, but actually I realised I had two episodes left. So I went to watch something, and it was like, oh, you know, carry on with this. And I was like, oh, I can finish my food documentary. High on the Hog is excellent. It is centered around African-American food. It takes this food writer, Stephen Satterfield, tracing the origins of these cuisines. The first season was focused a lot more on Africa. The second season sees him traveling around America. I really like the episodes that were based in Harlem. It's just such a really good watch. And it doesn't just talk about the kind of histories of these foods and obviously tracing that, although that's obviously central and important. They are cooking the food as well, and you can see that. They go to community-based places, restaurants, chefs. They really do talk to the people. I thought, well, obviously I don't know necessarily who all the experts are in that field, but it seems like there's a rich source of experts within the documentary. And also they talk about some of the contemporary issues with food, and you know, access to healthy food. I think they call it, it used to be known, the issue, as like food deserts, specifically in America, but actually a better term for it being food apartheid. And so they talk about that, and they really get into some of the issues with the way in which food is being produced, who has access to food, the way in which enslaved people were given kind of the worst cuts or the undesirable parts of meat, and then have turned these into kind of delicacies that have now been gentrified in a sense, and then taken, and the prices have soared even though they started as such undesirable things. And you know, we can see this in Caribbean cooking as well. And so yeah, I really enjoyed that. What I'm reading, I haven't actually started it yet, but I'm so excited, it's on my desk, is a great scholar, April Louise Pennant's book. It's her debut. Baby Girl, You've Got This: Experiences of Black Girls and Women in the English Education System. I'm so excited to read it. I got it on pre-order. I don't pre-order many books because obviously you just don't know, do you? But I pre-ordered this one, and it arrived. I got it when I got back home, and I am excited to jump into it, and looking at black girls and women in education, to kind of partly to think about my PhD, obviously I look at education, but also to maybe potentially think about my own life as a black woman and former black girl within English education, or still in the English education system, to be quite honest. So I think this book would be actually potentially transformative in my understanding of self and my understanding of the education system, which will help both academically and personally. So I'm very grateful for this text. Shout out to you, April Louise. So excited to get to some of the book launches for that as well. I think the next one is the 15th of March at the British Library, if you're listening to this episode before that. So thank you so much for tuning into this podcast episode. We will be back in 2 weeks' time. Episodes will come out fortnightly. I'm not sure how I feel about the fortnightly thing still, but we're going with it for now. Let me know what you think about the episode, and let me know what you think about the Bob Marley film too. Thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful week. Goodbye. That's it for another episode of the History Hotline. If you enjoyed it, please rate and review us on whatever podcast platform you listen to, or tell a friend to tell a friend. To continue the conversation, follow us on social media at The History Hotline on Instagram and at The History HL on Twitter. The History Hotline is hosted by me, Deanna Lynn Cook. Research and marketing done by Zakia Riaz. Production by Waylon Mackenzie Witter, and original music provided by Royal Sounds. Sponsored by Musetopia. History Hotline.